From Public Radio International, I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Graphic novels or comic books without the comedy burst out of the underground into the big time with Art Spiegelman's Mouse in the early 1990s. In a new century, in the hands of artist writers like Chris Ware and his Jimmy Corrigan serial, or Charles Burns and his grim Black Hole series about a monstrously deforming AIDS-like infection, the graphic novel is by now a medium with some real masters in full flower, a medium with a grip on imaginative darkness that might not fit anyplace else. Not straight prose, not horror movies either. Jimmy Corrigan's subtitle is The Smartest Boy on Earth, but the threads of Jimmy's story are abandonment, alienation, emotional violence inside a family. Charles Burns' images, black as tar, give you middle American post-teens in whirlpools of dread, creepy lust, remorse, and death. So forget Little Lulu and Donald Duck. The heirs of Poe and Dickinson in pictures are next on Open Source. First the news. We'll be right back. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source, a radio conversation about a culture trying to happen. This hour, we're talking about the bleak but irresistible charm in the exquisite drawing and the dark ideas driving these new graphic novels. The emotional moonscapes, for example, of Chris Ware's catatonic so-called funny pages, now a regular feature in the Sunday New York Times, which of course never ran comics. Or, for example, Charles Burns's erotic, psychotic epic, 10 years in the writing and inking, called, what are we called? Black Hole, about fixated teenagers being wasted by all the usual suspects, sex, drugs, and rock and roll, and by a new STD that produces boils, scales, animal tails, horns, gills, and other unlovely mutations. These are some of the prices of adulthood in the book genre that is now outgrown cult status. Listeners, what's going on here? Can we laugh about it? Is this Mad Magazine gone modern, or is it something much older and maybe much darker? Join the comics conversation on the open source phone, 877-673-6767, or jump onto the website and look at what we're talking about. Chris Ware, welcome back to radio. For a few poor creatures out there who don't know Jimmy Corrigan and your new collection, this spring novelty library, I wish you'd just take any one of these strips and tell the story without benefit of pictures.
Okay.
Maybe people can see the pictures in their imaginations.
Right.
Well, Rocket Sam, maybe, or Big Tex.
Okay. I should say initially that these the strips that composed this book were drawn either simultaneous to or following Jimmy Corrigan. I'm working on two other long-form serious books now, and these were all sorts of strips that I did to sort of stay acquainted with the more humorous side of comics, even though by the time I was done doing each strip, they ended up being not so funny. But it was sort of a way of relieving tension when I was working on the longer stories. Anyway, I guess some of the strips that I did were almost entirely without words, so that's the one I'll attempt to describe here, since I find reading the dialogue balloons that I've written almost unbearable. So there's a character named Rocket Sam, who's essentially sort of an overweight spaceman who crash lands on an unnamed planet, and there's about six or seven strips in the book that tell the story of him trying to essentially not avoid loneliness. So this particular strip begins with him building a robot, the arms of which are shown much more dramatically than maybe they might be otherwise. He's attaching arms to this robot, and the title is "These Arms Were Made for Hugging." And essentially, he builds this robot simply so that he can push a button on it and it leans forward and hugs him. So, which he does a number of times, and runs around with the robot, commenting on trees and flowers and birds on this particular lonely planet where he's the only single organism, basically, except for this robot, and sort of builds up a warm relationship. But then one day when the robot's really grown to actually care for him and he's picking flowers for Rocket Sam, he sees around the corner that a rescue ship has actually landed and picked up Rocket Sam, who very gleefully jumps in it and flies away. And the robot's left completely alone now on the planet. And the last panel is the robot at night hugging the trunk of a tree to try to console himself.
Oh, it's so beautiful.
Sorry.
We need a hug after that.
Well, it's kind of weird to try to describe it. But I guess, I mean, even though this is kind of a gag, I try, in everything I do, I try to have as much emotion as possible as I can. And I really do want to get to some emotional core. However goofy this may be, like in the other stories that I've done, I tried to do it in a much more literary or naturalistic way. But in this case, it's these particular gag strips, I've tried to use sort of the mechanisms of gag telling, which of course comics are very well suited to, and maybe try to imbue a little bit more emotion into them. But
so the story is poor old Rocket Sam, alone on his far planet, and makes a robot that he can hug, and then abandons the robot as he'd been abandoned, and the robot
in the last picture is desperately hugging a tree. What is the drawing all about? This is itself very, very stylized. I'm not sure I ever saw. I mean, we know the Jimmy Corrigan look now, rather roundish, blankish human bodies, but the whole thing is so beautifully composed. What's to say about your design?
Well, I mean, comics are actually kind of an art of composition in and of themselves. So I sort of feel like the page is the first thing that you see, and then it's the cartoonist's duty to try to craft a visual composition that leads the reader pictorially through a story that they can make sense of. And the actual sort of really cold, dead drawing style that I've arrived at is sort of halfway the result of imitating hand-done typography and applying it to how into simple drawing, essentially simplifying it down to almost sort of an ideogram or a pictograph. And beyond that, it's just a lot of mistakes, I guess, actually, that then accrue to make what one might loosely term a style. So,
all done by hand here, even the lettering, right?
Right, yeah.
Charles Burns, Chris Ware is a day at the beach compared to your work in general, and certainly Black Hole. The end papers in this book, inside the front and back covers, are sort of a simulation of high school yearbook pictures. At the front, they're smiling American 19-year-olds, 18-year-olds. In the back, they're grotesquely transformed by boils and bumps and overgrown teeth and hair miscellaneously falling out. Can you summarize the story between beginning and end, and then a little bit about where it came from and what it means?
Oh, well, I'm never great at this, but
yes, you are.
The pictures that I used for the portraits you were just mentioning are actually from my high school yearbook, and I created this story, a black hole I was trying to examine adolescence in general, and I came up with the idea of having this metaphor of a disease that occurs to adolescents, and trying to examine that. So I did use this kind of before and after pictures just for fun and a little bit of payback to some people I wasn't crazy about in high school. I don't know. I mean, I don't know if there's.
Was this your adolescence? You're the parent by now of adolescents, but
that's true. I mean, it's much darker than my. I mean, when I was growing up, it was much more benign and much more simple than what I'm portraying here. The whole idea of using this disease, I could have told the story fairly straight of the kind of alienation that these characters are going through, but I wanted to I used the disease as a way of like a catalyst of kind of pushing the story forward in a more, you know, more extreme fashion.
Which it surely does. It's kind of Invasion of the Body Snatchers plus AIDS, it struck me as I read it. It's sexually transmitted. It also has a big quotient of thuggery about it.
I really wasn't interested in. I mean, any time that you talk about or you have a story that involves sexually transmitted disease, then of course you're going to think about AIDS. But I wasn't. It really wasn't a story about that. Again, it was more of a device to examine the extremes of adolescence, the transformation of someone who's a child into adulthood, and maybe after you reach adulthood, you're cured of that disease.
Hmm. Should we talk about the visuals? I mean, which are very dark indeed. They have the kids in them, and they're kind of old teenagers, I must say, but they look like sort of 50s comics figures in certain ways. But the page after page, they're very, very black. There's much more black than white in this book. It's sort of Dürer at his darkest, maybe.
Right. There are a few, very few parts of the book where it lightens a little bit. There's a scene where the characters there's a romantic interlude where they got to the beach and the sky lightens up, it kind of opens up. Mm-hmm. But it's predominantly takes place either out in the woods where kids have kind of escaped from the rest of their community, and or at night, or interiors of houses where it's relatively black. So, yes, indeed, it's black.
Why is it so black?
I don't know. I mean, I think that it reflects, you know, how I felt that during that age growing up, and I don't know. Maybe that's where my mind wanders when I go back to that era.
I guess what we're trying to figure out as we read these books, and we've talked about it in our own kind of staff gatherings incessantly, is what it is about the darkness of the imagination that is peculiarly revealed in this graphic medium. I've never seen a movie like this. I don't think I could read a book like Black Hole, and yet it's found a perfect marriage in this form.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, for me, it was just the story that I wanted to tell. I mean, this was I don't know. I've always been kind of drawn towards the horrific, and I don't know. I mean, I literally felt kind of like a monster when I was going through adolescence, and this is kind of a reflection of that.
I wish every listener could see how utterly unmonstrous and perfectly, you know, a fine child of suburban Seattle, I suspect, we're looking at here.
People meet me and they there is a look of disappointment sometimes. they either expect, you know, some horrible tattoo on my forehead, or they expect, you know, a very strange, withered old man that's been, you know, often off by himself for years and years.
Okay, here's the question for listeners about Chris Ware. What would you expect the author, the inventor of Jimmy Corrigan to look like? We'll answer that after a short break. 877-673-6767 is the open source phone, or you can log on at radioopensource.org. We're talking about the new comics. We'll be back.
Hi, this is Brendan. I'm the Blogger-in-Chief. So, sometimes a show will rise from the ashes to which we had consigned it. 2 months ago, we started a thread on morality and religion. Katrina diverted us, and now this week we return to do justice to the 22 rather lengthy comments that showed up in our absence. Also, Don Quixote is 400 years old, Nabokov called it a crude and cruel masterpiece, Chris calls it the model of an open-source novel. Weigh in at radioopensource.org.
Open Source is produced in association with the University of Massachusetts at Lowell and WGBH Radio Boston. This is Open Source from PRI. I'm Christopher Light, and this is Open Source. This hour, we're talking about the gravitas of the graphic novel. Here are some excerpts from films honoring the art form.
From off the streets of Cleveland, please say hello to Harvey Pekar.
You're Harvey Pekar. You're famous.
Son, you're damn good.
You're the embodiment of the American dream.
Walk down the right back alley in Sin City, and you can find anything.
What is it about? 5 or 6, I was sexually attracted to Bugs Bunny, and I cut out this Bugs Bunny off the cover of a comic book and carried it around with me. Girls are just utterly out of my reach. They won't even let me draw them. Yeah, all that changed after I got famous.
We're talking about a medium of darkness known as... What do we call this?
I call it comics. The whole graphic novel thing to me, as Dan Klaus puts it, it makes us sound like pornographers. So I actually prefer the word comics because it, not only does it sort of diffuse the whole idea that what we're doing is different from our predecessors, but I think it also sort of honors them because they really kind of got the shaft in a lot of ways from their publishers. So I don't want anybody to think we feel like we're better than they are. So.
This is Chris Ware speaking. People are vaguely aware of a certain correspondence between your life and Jimmy Corrigan's, but where does the darkness in very likable Chris Ware come from?
You know, I don't really even feel that dark. I mean, I sort of feel I get asked this question every once in a while that I like, why am I trying to depress people or why don't I do more happy strips? And I sort of feel like what I do is happy because I never trust writers or artists to do stories that are always happy. I sort of feel like happiness is actually even sort of, it's almost sort of rude to make that your aim, or somehow it seems immoral to write about happiness, because it's such a byproduct of human experience that seems so subjective and almost indulgent that I feel like my aim is much more to try to create a sense of what it feels like to really be alive. And happiness doesn't really play a great part of that, you know, into my own life. So if I try to magnify that aspect of it, I just try to keep the proportion about the same, I guess, which is probably 2% happy and 98% worrying, I guess.
Worrying is okay, but there's a glumness about poor Jimmy that doesn't fit you at all.
Well, I wrote that about 10 years ago or so when I was a little bit more glum, I guess, and a little bit more lonely. And now I'm married and I have a daughter, and so I feel a little bit different. I think I was the self-indulgent 20-some-year-old or so when I did that story. So I don't know. I really don't want to depress anyone. That's not my...
Listen, I want to just... We have to tackle or at least touch this matter of comics, you know, coming of age or growing up. Uh-huh. I think we're much more persuaded by the notion that somehow comics have gone back to the future. Art Spiegelman said that the future of comics is in the past, and you both kind of glorify the work of, you know, practitioners almost a century ago. Mm-hmm. Introduce them for those of us, you know, who just barely remember Gasoline Alley.
Sure. Frank King was a cartoonist who was from Wisconsin but lived in Chicago the better part of his most creative years, I think, and he did a strip called Gasoline Alley, which its most defining and overwhelmingly innovative characteristic was that all of the characters aged at the rate of one day per strip, which is essentially concurrent with everybody reading the strip. So in the time that Frank King was alive, the character of Skeezix aged at the same rate as his own son, with whom he had a rather troubled relationship. And the strip actually ends up being King's own fantasy, essentially, of what a relationship with a son that he really didn't necessarily have, because his son was away at military school for most of his growing up. So
sound like Harry Potter, doesn't it? I mean,
well, I don't know. I mean, it's actually one of the most sensitive, soft strips ever to see print. In fact, I think it's the first print to actually be able to capture sort of a fluid slowness and honesty about life in a medium that's actually very brittle and staccato, which is what drew me to it when I was a young cartoonist. And he doesn't do it in the drawing, he does it in the pacing, which is where the real engine of comics is, actually.
Explain that.
It has more to do with how you divide the pictures and divide up time and how the pictures move between each other when you're reading them, not with necessarily how you draw them. You could draw a very soft picture in comics, but then it becomes harder to read. So you have to find a way to work with a very, chiaroscuro, I guess, sort of like you're talking about, why is Charles's book so black and white? You have to find a way to make that work so that when you read it, it still has a fluidity of motion to it, and a fluidity of a sort of a softness. I mean, I want it to feel real, so there's sort of a difficult aesthetic problem, actually, to balance those two tensions, I think. In a way, it's sort of, I'm really attracted to the music of ragtime, because when you think of it, it's a very percussive, kind of aggressive music that seems happy on the surface, but there's a deep undercurrent of emotion and disappointment that's encoded into it, and it comes through, and it can actually deeply move you if you really listen to the music. So I think there's sort of a, and comics and ragtime developed almost concurrently, so I think there's a mild connection there, actually. But
Charles Burns, your totally different look reminds me of wood engravings, actually. Would you sort of pay the appropriate homage to whoever it is you're inspired by?
Well, I grew up in the 50s and 60s, and in our household, I think my father was a little bit of a frustrated cartoonist himself, and he had an interest in classic American comic strips, and he would go to the library, bring collections home, bring art books home. So before I could even read, I was always kind of I had to entertain myself a lot, or I found myself in a situation where I needed to entertain myself. So I would just look at books and look at comics, there were comics that I was looking at that I had absolutely no idea what the cultural references were, and I would end up making up my own stories because I couldn't read. So some of the things that were around the house, which sound very odd, there were some paperback collections of the early Mad comics. This predates Mad magazine. Hmm. So they're actually just there were comics that were written by Harvey Kurtzman and a number of different cartoonists did the illustrations.
He became Mad magazine, of course.
What's that?
Harvey Kurtzman.
He started the actual magazine, but then parted ways with the publisher. But anyway, I was looking at these early Mad comics again, like not knowing all the cultural references, but looking at these black and white reproductions that, I mean, I think they were supposed to be funny, but they looked very very dark and very scary to me. And somehow, I think that kind of mood embedded itself in my brain at that early age, and I think that the way that I draw is in a certain sense emulating that kind of feeling that I had when I was very young.
What do you want to say to all the frustrated cartoonists out there? And there are lots of them.
Don't quit your day job. I think it's something that Chris and I both pursued comics out of Not for fame or glory, or not for the big bucks. I mean, it was just something that we were drawn to, and I don't know, Chris.
Because we didn't have friends mostly. I think it was like a way of somehow doing something that would keep you occupied while the other kids, like, you know, you avoided getting punched in the hallway or something like that. That's a story that I think Robert Crumb could tell or Charles Schulz could tell, but I don't necessarily think that's what's going into younger cartoonists these days necessarily. So I don't know what's going to come of it, but at least I know that's part of my personal story. So
our phone is 877-673-6767. We're talking about graphic novels, or as Chris Ware prefers to call them, just comics, modern dark comics in hardcovers. 877-673-6767. Henry Jenkins is on the line, founder and co-director of MIT's Comparative Media Studies. He teaches a course on comics. He's currently writing a book on genre and comic books. Henry Jenkins, what's this all about?
Well, that's a large and broad question. I mean, I think what we're seeing has been an explosion of creativity in comics as a medium, both in the mainstream and on the fringes. We're seeing growing literary and artistic respectability ascribed to an extending number of artists, two of which you have on your show. We're seeing genre comics become richer and more complex and a broader.
What's a genre comic?
I mean, right now you're talking about dark and modern, but there are funny comics out there. There are superhero comics out there that are as complex as anything that we've seen in a long, long time within this medium. I think what the key thing you want to say about graphic novels right now is it is enormous diversity in what's being created, and it's generating a lot of excitement among the students here at MIT and elsewhere in the medium as a whole. You know, Scott McCloud, who did a book, Understanding Comics, makes the case that comics are a medium and they can tell almost any kind of story they want to tell, and I think we're reaching the point where we're seeing that happen.
There's the puzzle. There's the why now question, but also why comics? Why not screenplays? Why not poetry? Why not movies? Or, I mean, with all the possibilities, say, in multimedia and the things you can do out of a Radio Shack kit, what's coalescing here in the comic book form, Henry?
Well, I think first of all, the meeting of text and images is very important. We have a generation that's very much drawn toward visual information and visual
right.
expression. I think there's a level of intimacy between the artist, the writer, and the reader that emerges in comics that's truly special.
Hmm.
I think the cost of production is lower, and so the barriers to entry are significantly lower, which allows people who have a creative impulse to experiment with comics in a way that it's difficult, even with our age of digital video production, to experiment with cinema in quite the same way. And I think someone like Art Spiegelman with Mouse opened the door for more cultural attention to be paid to comics as a medium and freed the space for artists to work. I think both of you worked with Raw at some point early in your career, and that was clearly a playground where a number of creative artists were brought together to do interesting work with Art Spiegelman and others sort of paving the way.
Henry Jenkins is the MIT guy who reads comics, the MIT professor who reads comics. I want to pick up on one special word you used there, Henry, and that was intimacy. And I feel it keenly. It's partly about the lonely, individual, long labor that produces these things and the fact that we can spend almost infinite time inspecting them in an equally sort of solitary mode. We get to know these guys almost better than we know novelists, don't you think?
I mean, I've never met either the author, but having spent a massive amount of time in their work, I do think I've seen parts of them that, you know, consciously or unconsciously are there on the page that do feel closer to me than most of the novelists that I read. I think I think you talked about, in terms of Charles Burns's work, the dark side, the grotesque side, but there's also enormous beauty in the way in which he represents these mutant characters. I wrote a piece recently on Matthew Barney, the avant-garde artist, which I made the argument that in some of what he's trying to realize in his work is better realized by popular artists from Charles Burns to Clive Barker to David Cronenberg, that there is a fascination with what humans could be if they were capable of being remapped, if they were capable of, their bodies were transformed in some way. So we can see it as disease, or we can see it as transformation. We can see it as realizing a kind of beauty that is in some cases literally skin deep in Charles Burns' work, and in some cases much more than that. And it's an art that emerges from the popular roots of this. I mean, I think what I like about Burns' work is the roots of EC Comics in the 50s, comics being realized for a new generation with a very different sensibility and sensuality.
The intimacy thing just completely fascinates me. We would be much more likely to take Jimmy Corrigan or anything by Chris Ware, or Charles Burns, for that matter, under the covers, than you would say Stephen King or Tolstoy or John Updike, perhaps. Are you guys aware, as you compose these things, and you answer, Charles, the loving attention to these black and white drawings, are you aware of a kind of, deep familiarity that you're drawing people into?
I'm never consciously creating my work for an audience out there. I think
really?
I think more than anything else, I'm trying to tell the story that is on my mind. I'm trying to get that story out, and comics are the way. I've got those skills to do it through comics. It's something I've been focused on all these years.
10 years on that book.
Yes, that's the part that's always a little disconcerting. I'm thinking about the fact that, you know, my daughter was, you know, running around. Now she's gone off to college, and now she's old enough to actually read the book. So, that part's a little bit hard to take. On the other hand, that's literally how long the story demanded. That's how long it took.
877-673-6767. Is the open source phone. Ben is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Good evening.
Evening,
Hello.
Ben.
Hi there.
Welcome.
I've been reading The Black Hole for the past 10 years as well. I even moved here in 1995 with a copy of number one.
Did you collect all the originals?
I have all 10 of them, and I think that the main question I have is, did it take that long to write the story, or did it take that long to draw it? Because for me, it seems working on something that long would, if you already knew how these characters were going to develop, I would think that could get boring.
Well, the writing and the drawing are so intertwined. I mean, they are the same thing. There's some portions of the story that are just purely visual, but they still have this, they still evoke this, you know, this very visceral response, at least for me.
When you brought up earlier, though, that some of the it works out for some of the characters and it doesn't work out for some of the other ones. I mean, early on in the series, you have no idea which ones those are going to be. And my favorite issue in the series, in fact, one of my favorite comics ever, is number 4, when we first have that scene in the basement with the girl with the tail who makes the art. And yeah, I was listening to you earlier when you were talking about how, for you, this story, you could take out the whole Teen Plague thing, and that's the one that really works for me. And you know, part of it is that you don't know if those two are the ones that are going to make it out. And
getting back to your earlier question about the writing, I had charted out the entire story from the beginning. I had to, because of the complexity of the story. But what made it interesting and what kept my my attention and my interest was the actual telling of the story through the comics, finding my way into the story, finding a way of like telling the story the perfect way, the best way, and that's what kept my focus.
The rules must be entirely different when you're telling a story in pictures than, say, you know, writing a Zadie Smith novel or something. Even if you're covering similar kinds of ground. What's the difference?
Well, in my case, and Charles is probably tired of hearing me talk about this, but I actually work much more improvisatorially. Is that the word? Probably not. But I tend to actually write more with pictures, because I find that anytime I try to script something out in advance in detail, I kill not only my interest in it, but also the possibility for any feeling of reality once I'm done with it and I can actually read it. So I try to allow the process of actually drawing pictures on the page to kind of, kickstart my memory, I guess, for lack of a more eloquent word. And I find myself going around corners in the drawings and remembering things about certain rooms of my childhood, and people suddenly come up again, and suddenly the story takes a completely different path. So it's a actually extraordinarily irresponsible way of writing. I wouldn't necessarily call it literary, but I think I'm trying to use the actual mechanism of writing and drawing comics to try to get more into my own memory and storytelling and what actually goes into writing fiction, I guess. So
we're going to take a short break. We're talking about the modern hardcover comics with two masters, Chris Ware and Charles Burns. Give them a call at 877-673-6767. Or log on to the website, see what we're talking about, and make a comment at radioopensource.org. This is Open Source from PRI. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. We're talking about graphic novels, a.k.a. hardcover comics. 877-673-6767. Joins the conversation with Chris Ware and Charles Burns. Charles Burns of Black Hole. Janet is calling from Newton, Massachusetts.
Hello?
Hello, Janet.
Hi. Are you there?
We are indeed.
Oh, okay.
As much as we ever are.
I'm on a cell phone, so... Uh-oh. It might sound kind of gushy and blurry and all that kind of stuff. So I have a completely different angle that I wanted to ask you guys about, and that is that I am actually a parent, and I grew up in the 50s and 60s, just like you guys did. And I had sisters, so I don't really, and I have two sons, so raising sons has been an interesting journey for me. And my son, who is 16, sometimes has used the language that I think Charles did about feeling like a monster. And I'm just wondering how you see that journey in terms of how your comic writing has helped you with that and how I can manage my own worry. I don't know whether one of you said that you're 98% worry and 2% happy. Well, that's how I feel as a parent raising a child who feels like he has all these monster and dark sides, and sometimes I get really scared. So,
Janet, have you read Black Hole?
What?
Have you read Black Hole?
No, I haven't read anything of yours.
I would say don't read it until your adolescents are in their 50s.
This is more like Dear Abby.
Yeah. All right, a little self-help now.
Yes, a little self-help.
I don't know if you actually want to take advice from a cartoonist. But,
I'll take advice from anyone.
Well, I think you kind of hit actually on part of what makes Charles's work actually so great, at least in my mind. I mean, I've been reading his work ever since I was a teenager, so I can kind of say that I think he was probably the one cartoonist in Raw magazine back in the 1980s that Art Spiegelman published who I really felt an immediate connection to, and I literally could not pull my eyes away from, not only for the way that he drew, but also the feelings that he elicited. And I think especially Black Hole, I mean, I've been reading it for 10 years. It's been a huge inspiration to me. And I think it captures this feeling of kind of hopelessness and change and something that you just can't quite put your finger on as an adolescent. And I think basically you're kind of answering maybe your own question, but I don't know. I wouldn't propose to offer any words of advice. I have a daughter who's 8 months old, though. So.
Charles, do you want to extend any family counsel here?
I don't know what I'd be able to say. I've got an 18-year-old daughter and a 16-year-old daughter, and they seem both healthy and happy, and they've looked over my shoulder while I'm working on Black Hole. I've actually been asked on occasions whether seeing my daughters grow up reflected into the story writing of Black Hole, and my answer is luckily that's not the case at all.
No tales on that.
No, there's nothing like that. And I could recognize things that they were going through, the kind of struggles that I can remember those kinds of struggles that I went through and see that in them in their lives. But I think my story really is much more personal. I mean, I've had friends who. Years later, friends that I grew up with years later tell me, you know what, you were going through something that we weren't going through. So there's something you said in that, okay?
877-673-6767 is our phone. Brendan Greeley, our blogmeister, is watching the web. What are people saying, Brendan?
We've got a comment from E. Flake. She's an illustrator in New York. So somebody had commented on the blog asking whether it was an art form or not. And she says she's kind of mystified by that question, and we should probably save it for another time. But her real question is, so far we've been focusing on the development of the art itself. And she says this stuff has been around for a while, and she really wants to know why the uptake now. Why is this form connecting with so many people? So her question is it the fact that they've gotten more exposure in the media, these authors, or is it that there's a real genuine desire that it's fulfilling right now?
I think that there should full disclosure here. I actually know Emily Flake is a cartoonist. She used to live in Chicago, which gives you an idea of how small our world is, actually. I'm assuming it's the same E. Flake. But I hear of this question a lot, and I think actually a lot of it can simply be attributed to, I mean, everybody's growing up. We're all getting older. And it's not like suddenly comics are getting into magazines that are being run and published by people who are staying the same age. I mean, people move out of jobs and into other jobs, and people who are the same age as me are now working in magazines and publications, and they grew up reading comics. So they're starting to bring in the things that they remember moving them when they were younger into a more contemporary adult world. And I mean, I could see maybe in 15 years, the New Yorker actually having video games printed on like digital paper or something like that. It's just a gradual transference of culture from one generation to another. And I think it's kind of illusory to say that it's it's suddenly coming of age or something, and then it's being forced down older
Henry
people's
Jenkins,
throats.
Do you have a theory about why now? Could it have anything to do with the decline of network television or even of Hollywood?
I wouldn't pit it against other media. I think it's more. I think the generational shift is very important. I think there's been an aesthetic that Spiegelman opened the doors for serious literary discussion of comics. That these things are being reviewed in the New York Times Book Review and so forth. And I think that opening the bookstores to them plays a large role. One of the significant things about graphic novels is they're published as books, and you can buy them at your Barnes and Nobles and your Borders in a way that for a long time comics were in the dark, dank basement dungeons presided over by guys who growled at the customers when they walked through the door. Now they're out in plain view, and people are stumbling into them and discovering they're not quite what they thought they were.
Should we say more about Art Spiegelman? I mean, the man who made a comic book mouse as the bearer of the story of the Holocaust, the man who did that famous, almost entirely pitch-black cover of The New Yorker after 9/11. I mean, a man of kind of unending originality.
Well, can I say one more thing?
Sure.
I just want to modify what I said last. I don't want to sound pessimistic or like I'm trying to find
you?
Some sort of anthropology.
Pessimistic?
Well, I also think I think they're becoming more visible simply because there's more cartoonists than ever before trying to do genuinely serious work about what it feels like to be alive, you know, and I mean, Emily is one of those. I think there's actually almost a countless number of cartoonists out there trying to do really good work, and I think it's connecting with more people. It's not as much of a commercial medium as it was, which is, again, very much due to Art Spiegelman's efforts, not only with Raw Magazine, but then also getting comics into details, and then The New Yorker, which we're all eternally grateful for, so...
Is it a newspaper medium anymore? I mean, the land of Lil Abner and Doonesbury and Mary Worth and all of those good folk.
I do a weekly strip in the Chicago Reader. Now it's sort of semi-weekly, and I'm also doing one in the New York Times. But Charles did a weekly strip in the 1980s. So it depends on how lenient your editors are, actually, I think, depending on whether you can do something that's maybe, literary or not, so...
I did reach a point. Chris was saying, talking about my weekly strip, and I did reach a point where I realized there was a certain amount of censorship that I was faced with. Just there's some subject matter that just you can't put into weekly newspapers or any newspapers, and not because I wanted to have, you know, gratuitous violence or explicit sex for the sake of, you know, I don't know, being titillating, but there were elements in my story that were more graphic and more difficult that just would not find their way into that kind of setting.
877-673-6767. Joined the conversation with Chris Ware and Charles Burns. Scott is calling from Brookline, Massachusetts.
Yeah, hi, Chris. You start out with a question about why they're all so dark. I think a number of people like Henry have pointed out that they're not all so dark, and I think if you look overseas, you see whole cultures of comics that cover the spectrum. But your other question about what's so special about comics, I just wanted to suggest one other possibility, which is we live in an age in which more and more media is being pushed at us, and we have less and less control over time and over the flow of that media. And what I love about comics is that, in fact, the reader is in control of time. The reader decides when to turn the page. And even though someone like Chris has fabulous timing like nobody else in the work, I, as a reader, can still sort of engage with him at the speed I want to and sort of replay it over and over again if I want to.
You can move backwards, too. I mean,
yeah, that's right. It's something you just don't have with any other media. I design computer games, and I find that the best computer games are the ones in which the user controls the flow of the action instead of just being forced into running with whatever the game makes them do. And I think that we live in an age when we just have so little control over our time that comics are a wonderful antidote.
Well said, Scott. What is the time consideration, Charles, in the way you put these things together?
I'm not quite sure I understand the...
Well, as Scott says, and I think Chris had touched on it, there is a... what you're doing in a certain way is manipulating... our sense of time.
Oh yeah, I mean it is a very
playing with it
intimate medium, and there's and when I was designing or writing the story, I'm conscious of the fact that it's something that you're looking at two pages facing each other. You're turning pages. There's a pace, the fact that you're looking at all these images together and then separately as the story unfolds, and hopefully you're successfully creating a successful story.
Actually, I mean,
Chris Ware.
I think the essence of comics is rhythm, actually, and effectively dividing time up into such a way. It's almost, I think of it actually more as music than anything else. And I try in my comics to try to get a sense, like when I'm trying to recreate a conversation, to get all of the right pauses and the right sort of movements and gestures that people make, so that it feels genuinely real when you read it. Because I want it to have that same feeling that you have while you're experiencing life around you. And I mean, that is my fundamental goal in comics, are a way of dividing that visually, that I don't think there's really any other, there's no other medium that I think permits that, because there's no other medium that you go through and read pictures that way. So,
Henry Jenkins, help us out in sort of identifying the forebears of this work. I mean, they're all over the place, in literature, maybe, in painting, in drawing, in every man. But I'm trying to think, you know, how many leaps between Chris Ware or Charles Burns and Edgar Allan Poe, for example, or Dostoevsky, or Emily Dickinson, for that matter?
Well, you're describing writers of very different relationships to their publics. I think Poe is probably the closest parallel to what we're talking about, in that he wrote short stories for mass market magazines that were popular at the time, even as they were part of a literary establishment. So if you look at someone like Charles Burns, he's someone who, like Poe, I think dips into the genre of horror, which has got very strong popular roots, but uses it to express a sense of time, a sense of place, but truly mood is what literary critics like to talk about in Poe, and I think it's very powerful here. These images express something very personal and yet something shared with a larger number of people. So I think you could certainly draw lines to Poe. The real connecting tissue would be the EC Comics of the 1950s, which came out at a point when people again were talking about comics coming of age and adult readers of comics and comics dealing with serious themes. And horror was used for political commentary in the McCarthy period. And I think that sense of political outrage and moral ambiguity of the EC Comics translates into some of the stuff that Charles Burns is working with today.
Are there other writers, playwrights for that matter, composers who are dealing in different media with this basic reserve of, I don't know what, insight?
Well, I mean, we're starting to see comics influence things like Cavalier and Clay or Fortress of Solitude, novels that are trying to capture the feel of comics and pull them into another kind of space. At the same time, we're seeing a lot of these themes that comics are trying to deal with. As I said earlier, the depiction of the post-human or the transhuman is a recurring theme across many different arts at the present time, as we live in a world of body piercing and tattooing and genetic engineering. People want to figure out where the line is between the human and what comes after it. And I see a lot of the images in Black Hole speak to something that the culture in general was searching toward.
Charles and Chris, who do you admire, you know, in among your colleagues in art in general, or writers? Who are the other people with whom you feel a kinship, and who does in different forms things that you can't do in comics?
Well, that's actually a big concern and frustration of mine. I'm reading Zadie Smith's new book right now, and I realize that in just one single page of eloquently told story that she puts down in prose that just comes to life in my mind, I would have to spend 3 weeks actually researching and drawing two or three pages of comics for an equivalent level of experience, I guess. And there's a...
She might have spent 3 weeks on the prose too, you know.
That's quite possible. But that's probably the biggest frustration for me is trying to get that same level of detail and intensity. And if part of the problem is, too, is that in comics, if you want to change something, you have to seriously go back in and redraw everything. You can't just simply rewrite it really quickly. There's nothing about comics that buoys you as a writer or an artist. It's a very brittle, kind of crafty medium, whereas I've found that in a few times that I've tried to actually write prose, it's almost like I'm creating a stream to row in or something. It's a kind of a dumb metaphor, but I...
Is it masochistic?
Comics? Yeah. Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't want to recreate what's going through my head when I'm drawing it. It's not a fun thing, actually. I talk to Art quite a bit on the phone sometimes about like our frustrations of just trying to stay seated and keep drawing. So it's the phone becomes kind of a connecting point for...
Let us in on that conversation. Chris says to Art, Art says to Chris, how does it go?
Well, it's just we kind of just bemoan our relative inability to kind of stay focused sometimes. It's very when you get an idea to do a strip, it's not like you just sit down and draw it in a fury. I mean, you might get a phone call or it takes days on end to do, and you to stay seated and stick with it through to the bitter end is kind of a difficult thing. And I don't mean to make it sound like what a terrible life I have, but it's not a very fluid kind of creative process.
I think we've also had, there have been conversations I've had with Art Spiegelman where we're kind of comparing notes and we're always kind of hoping that someone out there, some cartoonist is really, really enjoying themselves. I mean, sometimes you're looking at work that just looks like it looks really fun, looks really, I mean, there's you know, occasionally you see someone who's working that way, but nobody I've talked to, unfortunately, you know, relates back to me that, you know, oh, yeah, it's easy, it's fun, I wake up and, you know.
Can hardly wait to draw.
Nobody expects it to be easy. I mean, that's why they pay the big bucks, right? But
the big bucks,
you should feel rewarded by it. Anybody else out there for you, Charles, that is sort of working the same vein of feeling and emotion in any medium that we want to acknowledge?
I can't, off the top of my head, I can't...
Stephen King or...
No, I'm not a big fan, so sorry, Stephen.
Nice try, Steve. Thank you. This is hugely fun. And the books are very powerful. Thank you, Chris Ware. Thank you, Charles Burns. Thank you, Henry Jenkins, who understands everything. You can continue talking about comics and help us work on the next shows at radioopensource.org, where you can also download any show and subscribe to Open Source as a podcast. Open Source is produced in association with the University of Massachusetts at Lowell and WGBH Radio in Boston. The program is made possible by the Schooner Foundation, whose contributors support the Landmine Survivors Network, offering health, opportunities, and rights to mine victims worldwide. www.landminesurvivors.org. Our show is produced by David Miller, Brendan Greeley, Catherine Bidwell, Chelsea Mers, and Robin Amer. Robin Moore was our engineer. Thanks also to David Cogger. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.
PRI, Public Radio International.